Good morning. I'm reading out of Luke 9. Make sure I have it right. As the time approached when Jesus was to be taken up into heaven, he determined to go to Jerusalem. He sent messengers on ahead of him. Along the way, they entered a Samaritan village to prepare for his arrival. But the Samaritan villagers refused to welcome him because he was determined to go to Jerusalem. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, "Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to consume them?" But Jesus turned and spoke sternly to them, and they went on to another village. As Jesus and his disciples traveled along the road, someone said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens, and the birds in the sky have nests, but the human one has no place to lay his head." Then Jesus said to someone else, "Follow me." He replied, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and spread the news of God's kingdom." Someone else said to Jesus, "I will follow you, Lord, but first let me say goodbye to those in my house." And Jesus said to him, "No one who puts a hand on the plow and looks back is fit for God's kingdom."
Thank you, Vicki. If you have your Bible and want to turn to Luke chapter 9, we will be there. And if you kind of want to keep up with another passage we'll look at, you might put your bulletin or your ribbon marker in for 2 Kings 1 and 2. Kara Slade holds a PhD in mechanical engineering and material science. She was a research person for at Langley, and then she went on to be a research engineer for NASA. And then she left. Well, that is, she left Langley, she left NASA to pursue degrees in, of all things, theology. She earned her MDiv and her PhD from Duke Divinity School, and she's now the theologian in residence at Princeton Seminary, the canon theologian for the Episcopal Diocese in New Jersey. I heard Kara speak this past February at a small conference in Tulsa. Some young pastor friends interviewed Kara recently, and they were asking a number of questions as she's now responsible for participating in the training of young ministers and assessing kind of what the environment's like and what they need and what they'll be doing. And someone decided to ask, well, like, what good is out there we can say the church is doing? And then, of course, there's always someone in the audience that says, well, could you tell us why it seems that people are so repelled by the church, even some Christians, from participating in the church? And she said this, the part that's on us, that is the part that's on the church, she said, is that the loudest among us speak from a substructure of cruelty. Will you pray with me? Lord Jesus, we live in an area where advertisements for foundation repair air often. No matter the company, they tout their technology that will fix the damage that results in structural problems in our homes. We ask you this day to renew us by your foundation, gifted us in the gospel of love, forgiveness, and grace. Without the work of your Spirit, we fall prey to the temptation to join in the calls for fiery judgment on those who reject you. But apart from your Spirit's work in us, we have no fruit that points people to your good news. So may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our Redeemer, and all God's people say. One of the consequences of working in the pool servicing industry in the 1980s, the late 1980s, was my family got to hear repeatedly, "There will be no swimming pool." My family heard it often, but we have always said we'd be happy to swim in your pool. Pools are hard work. I mean, last year I relented. That's a softer word than repented. It happens when grandchildren come along. Could we put a small above-ground pool in your backyard? At your house? They did. And I spent nearly all month trying to get the pool to look exactly like those apartment pool complexes I cleaned back in the 80s. Crystal clear, perfect chemistry, just inviting you to dive in. Only two of my grandboys will dive in that pool. The one that's in the backyard that I'm still working on. It looks like the Illinois that we will float tomorrow. When pool water doesn't look like it's supposed to, there are a variety of reasons. But before you can address the problem that is created, you really have to understand what's the foundation to the water. That is, what's the water like? So we used to carry around these blue test cases with these different chemicals. We would then add these chemicals to find out, well, is the stabilizer good enough? Do you have enough stabilizer in that pool water? Is the pH correct? Is the alkalinity too high or too low? And do you have enough free chlorine? Not combined chlorine, but do you have enough free chlorine in the pool? That's the substructure that has to be correct before you can address really whether there's algae in the pool or you've got something else going on that you need to treat the water for. And if that analogy doesn't work to kind of create the image of what does substructure mean, then return with me back to what we talked about with the children when we talked about soil. And if you set out to plant a garden just like I did the very first time, we thought, well, we've got 2.5 acres. Certainly we can have a garden. Oh, that's work too. Then you find out that you got to find out, do you have sandy soil or is there enough nutrients in it? And I mean, those tomato plants looked so great when I bought them. But there wasn't anything in that soil to help those buds stay on, and I had pretty, pretty buds, no fruit. Well, have you worked that ground, someone like Glenn would say. You got to get that dirt right, or you're never going to have the sort of fruit you aim to have. And what's in the soil? What's in the soil is a substructure that's available to whatever you plant in the ground so that it will have all the nutrients it needs. The setting will be just right for the fruit. So the composition of your soil or the conditioning of your water, they're the substructure that helps you then determine what will be fruitful, what will grow. Will it be good or will it be bad? When Kara Slade answered the question about the decline of church attendance and participation by the curious and even Christians, she described a level at the substructure. That is, now in the role of training ministers and assessing the conditions of the culture into which these young ministers will venture out into, she considers the root of the rejection of the church, of even the good news, of even of Jesus, to in part, be due to the soil, our soil sometimes, that produces cruelty. So if we stay with that image, if you'll stay with me for just a minute, if you'll not ignore and immediately take offense to that, Galatians, the epistle reading for today, the letter of Paul that we had for today in Galatians 5 is pretty helpful to us. Paul describes the fruit of the Spirit. What we often do with that list of 9 is we create ourselves a new checklist. If you want to know how your progress and sanctification is going, are you working hard enough? Are you doing enough to produce that kind of fruit? You then always assume that every instance is an occasion for you to exhibit your gentleness. And then you find out you've not been very. It's an occasion to put in that work of patience, and then you realize you flew off the handle before you had time to think about that thing. I guess the aim of what I'm suggesting is that Paul emphasizes that this is the fruit of the activity of the Spirit. That when you set up the contrast in what's going on in Galatians 5, we are all too comfortable in the works of the flesh. It's what's natural. It's what our soil is like. It's what the condition of our water is naturally like. We really are more interested in us than anything else. So God gives us His Spirit who says, I'm going to recreate something new in you, and here's how the world is going to see it. I'm going to produce in you who were once the most impatient person on the planet, and I'm going to give glimpses of patience at work in you by my Spirit. You were the least loving person some people had ever met, and I am going to, by my Spirit, work in you a renewal that now the world sees in you a love they've never seen from you before. If you and I could muster that apart from the Spirit of God, apart from the good news of Jesus, why wouldn't we do that? And so Paul says, we don't do that because we're really consumed with ourselves. And he gives a long list of the works of the flesh, long before he writes, by contrast, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. There is no law against such things. So Paul's logic is that when Christ sets us free from the law of sin and death, we have now been given the Spirit that creates a new substructure, a new soil, reconditioned water, or newly conditioned water for our lives. So rather than fulfill what Paul describes as these works of the flesh, these desires of the flesh, we, Paul says, are instructed, live by the Spirit. If the Spirit is leading you to be loving, give in to that Spirit to be loving. You know, it's happened to you, right? I mean, it's a caricature. It's not really what happens, but it is actually how we live the experience. I've got the good voice on my right side and the bad voice on my left side. And most of my life, it's the bad voice that's been winning. And God recreates, redreams for me what I will be like. And now I'm hearing more often than not, I'm hearing this. Which one am I going to respond to? The Spirit is drawing me into responding to His action by, okay, I'm going to make the best next loving decision that's available to me. And the way we progress is as the Spirit leads us, the Spirit leads us to make the best, next, most loving decision, the next, best, most patient decision, and on we could go through the fruit of the Spirit. Our aim is that out of that soil that has been recreated, we will live out by following the Spirit the decisions to make the next best decision that we're being led to, whether that's generosity, whether that's faithfulness, whether that's kindness, whether that's joy, or whether that's peace. But these are things the Spirit of God is working in us, leading, drawing us to make the next most faithful decision to the new life that has been given and gifted to us in Jesus Christ. But the desires of the flesh are still very tempting to us. We really like ourselves. And some days we care more about us than others. That's why Paul uses Jesus as the analogy when he says, think about others as more important than yourselves, and then gives us the Christ hymn in Philippians 2. He knows what we're like. He knows what we're capable and sometimes what we're incapable of. And this substructure of selfishness is really what Kara Slade was talking about when she described a substructure of cruelty. Paul wants us to follow the Spirit because following the Spirit creates that substructure where the world now sees that our greatest interest is love for our neighbor. That's why he says the law is summed up in love your neighbor. That's the sum total of the law. he writes just that very thing. And the works of the flesh, what we desire, is what gets in the way. And what's on display in the passage that Vicky read, what's on display, the selfishness, the desire that's on display when James and John say what they say to Jesus, has been foretold to us, has been forecast for us in the conversation that James and John's mother has with Jesus. You remember that moment? I've got something I'd like to ask. Well, what would you like to ask? Well, I'd really like for James and John to sit at your right and your left hand when you come into your kingdom. She completely misses Jesus' message, just like the disciples did. So this is an equal gender offending instance. So we're not just blaming moms, but the disciples seem to be just as thick-headed about it. She misses that Jesus' message is that the kingdom does not operate. It's not built on the substructure of power over others. A power that expresses itself in cruelty. You ready? Sometimes disguised as good. When James and John witnessed the rejection of Jesus by the Samaritan town, that Samaritan village, they offer cruelty disguised as a good. Now, if you don't make it with me all the way to the end, don't forget that line. I tried to think of a way to make that the title, but if I were to title this sermon, I would say, "Stop calling down fire." Stop calling down fire. What they do, Lord, this is what they say. Do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? James and John were indignant at the rejection of Jesus by the Samaritan village. The trouble had already been brewing. It had already been building. The royal family, Herod's family, they thought they had rid themselves of the meddling religious types after Herod had John beheaded. And upon hearing the stir about Jesus, just above this passage, just a little bit before in chapter 9, Herod is thinking to himself, I thought I got rid of John. So he actually tried to see Jesus. I got to check this out. I thought I got rid of those meddling voices. After the highlights in the previous verses in chapter 9, the highlights are the feeding of the 5,000 and Peter's great confession, Thou art the Christ, Thou art the Son of the living God. Jesus tells the disciples this, plain as day, the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. Listen, rejection was the expectation. It was not a surprise. Do you get the sequence? Jesus had already told them he's going to be rejected. And as in something of a fulfilled prophecy, what happens? He goes to a Samaritan village and he's what? Rejected. And James and John are surprised. I don't know if that's as shocking to you as it is to me, but I'm like, he just said, I'm going to be rejected. And you seem shocked. And you're indignant that Jesus said the very thing that was going to happen, happened. Jesus knew what was coming. He had been trying to prepare the disciples, but their substructure of how the world works, their intense interest in having power over others, their concern for making sure they were large and in charge, overranked anything that Jesus said. They could not see it any other way. The church, capital C, big church, broad church, church capital C in the West, is having a hard time grappling with the cultural shift away from Jesus and even more from the church. But what Jesus was rejected for and what the church in the West and America faces, at least here for sure, is indeed what Kara Slade refers to as a substructure of cruelty. We suffer, hear me, we suffer not as Christians as a result of our self-giving, other-directed love, but soil that produces bitter fruit, unsatisfied when the world doesn't go our way. And embittered we are. And embittered we get. For years we've sat in the culture's driver's seat, and we were so fooled into thinking that the world now operates according to our interpretation of Jesus and His kingdom. But underdeveloped soil, soil that's not being worked by the Spirit of God, cannot produce the fruit Paul describes in Galatians 5. Can't. That's like asking your 7-year-old to solve algebra 2 equations. Unless they're just a child prodigy, that's not going to happen. It has to be cultivated and developed. They have to learn all of the other basics before they get to analytic algebra. When we have the expectation that the world is going to produce the fruit that Paul describes, we have been sitting in the driver's seat for far too long and maybe never should have been in it in the first place. And when we opt for James and John's attitude toward those that reject Jesus, we admit that we've not been paying attention ourselves to Jesus. We sound just as cruel thinking we are offering a good. What did Jesus do when this happened? What did He do? When James and John said, "Do you want us, Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven?" Luke is pretty plain spoken, blunt, if you will. Jesus rebuked them, and they went on to the next village. Now, I like you. What in the world got into James and John? What is it? I mean, certainly it is that they had a hard time grasping that Jesus was introducing something new, something different, a different way in the world, that they could no longer yearn and long for being in the driver's seat, being in first place, being in charge, being in power. Surely they had a hard time, but maybe there's something that had just happened to them. I don't know if we could get this entered as some sort of condition, but maybe they had now Elijah brain. Elijah brain. I have to tell you, again, I find it ironic that here we are revisiting Elijah as a character and finding that Elijah can be just as much an anti-type than a type. Well, what that means is that sometimes we look at Elijah, some thought Jesus was who? Remember? They thought He was Elijah or one of the prophets. But there's enough evidence in 1 Kings and 2 Kings that Elijah was as much an anti-type of Jesus as he was a type. And so if you go back and you read what's going on here, one in this passage, just up from where we are, just a couple of episodes earlier in Luke 9, James and John were two of the three disciples that actually saw Jesus transfigured on Mount Tabor, the mountain on which we believe the transfiguration took place. And who was there with Jesus? Moses and Elijah. There they are. So here they come down the mountain, and they got Elijah brain. I mean, it must be that everything Elijah ever did is sanctioned and endorsed, because on that mountain, there it is, to Jesus' left and His right are Moses and Elijah, the very two places that James and John want to occupy. And maybe they can actually get a jump start on the other 10 to seize those places if they can replicate Elijah, if I can just do what Elijah did. So you go read the passage. You go read 2 Kings 1. And you find out that here we are again. Elijah, the victor over the prophets of Baal, then what does he do? Of his own desire, he slaughters 450 prophets of Baal. Nowhere in the text is he instructed to do that. Nowhere. Thinking that he solved his problem by both defeating Baal on the altar and killing 450 of Baal's prophets, he thinks he's okay until he catches word that Jezebel is after him. Remember, he flees? And when he flees, he's ready to die. Just take my life. And what does God do? He nourishes him. He feeds him. He restores him. And he says, you have more work to do. So we get to chapter 1. And Ahaziah, Ahab's son, is now sitting on the throne. And he had a fall. Not sure exactly how he fell, but the text says he fell and he injured himself and he's now confined to the bed and he wants to know, is this how it's going to end for me? Am I going to get any better? And because he had a father who preferred Baal over Yahweh, he did what his daddy did. Let's go ask the prophets of Baal. Let's go find out who can tell me whether this is a permanent condition. So he sends his messengers out. God comes to Elijah and says, hey, it's time for an interception. It's time for an intervention. Ahaziah is going to make a huge mistake. You go catch his messengers and you tell him he will not recover from this injury. No need to go to the prophets of Baal, Zebub. Did you see that? Maybe you've not opened up your text to 1 Kings 1, but that was the name of the God that Ahaziah was going to go see. The prophets of Baal Zebub. Does that conjure any instance in Jesus' ministry for you? Didn't they accuse Jesus of casting out demons by Baal Zebub? Yeah, indeed. In fact, scholars think that this is actually a little bit of a scribal name change, a little change, because Ahaziah certainly believed he was going to go visit the representatives of the God of healing. But when you change that just a hair, it becomes the Lord of the Flies. You're going to go inquire from the Lord of the Flies. Really? Yahweh's already defeated Baal in all Baal's forms. And you're really going to send messengers there? And then Elijah returns, probably returns to the hill. The hill that he probably returned to, ready? Mount Carmel. Probably the hill that he kind of was his home base, home place, and he was sitting on the hill. And Ahaziah got the word. He didn't know who it was. In fact, it's kind of funny. He asked the messengers, who was this fellow who told you that? We really don't know. We just know he was hairy and wore a leather belt. And Ahaziah knew enough about Elijah to know that's Elijah the Tishbite. So what did he do? He sent a captain and 50 soldiers. Come, I want to talk to you. Elijah, if I am a man of God, may fire fall from the sky and consume you. Poof. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, 50 soldiers and a captain. Ahaziah does it again. He sends another captain, 50 more soldiers. If I am a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you. Poof. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Now we read the text. We need to read it the exact same way, I think, we should read Elijah's interest in slaughtering the prophets of Baal. Why? Because the next thing that happens is an angel of the Lord visits Elijah and says, no more fire. You go. You go with them. And here's what you say to them. But what he said, if you catch the line, you go, ready for this? Don't be afraid. Why? Why did Elijah call down fire from heaven? He was afraid. Afraid after the victory on Mount Carmel, where he didn't lift so much as a finger, only a voice in prayer. And after that, what did he do? He reverted back to his subculture, his substructure. I want those people dead. I don't want to deal with Ahaziah's captains nor his soldiers. I want him dead. What did God want? God wanted a voice for himself, even to those who rejected. Maybe this is why. Maybe this is exactly why Jesus turns to James and John and rebuked them. We don't do things the way Elijah does. Someone rejects me, we don't immediately call fire down from heaven. We are going to show hospitality. Because right at the top of this, right up at the top of chapter 9 nearly, Jesus sends out the 12. He sends out the 12 and he gives them instructions of what to do. Do you remember what he said to do when they went to a town that did not receive them? Shake the dust off your shoes. Nowhere does Jesus say, if they don't receive you, just call fire down from heaven. We'll smote the world that rejects me. Stop. Stop raining down fire. If that isn't a message for the church, in a culture that no longer takes us terribly serious and is not terribly interested in the good news, fighting fire with fire will never win a thing. And when we do this, see if this doesn't fit Elijah's anger. The works of the flesh are enmity, strife, anger, quarreling, dissensions, factions. Oh, there's a much longer list than that. But if that doesn't characterize the world in which we live, where we can't easily see that the works of the flesh are large and in charge, remember that what we do is we take those others in every list we find and we kind of slide by the ones that we have trouble with, and we make sure to emphasize those we know they have trouble with. And that's how we, us and them, the world. But at any point, we, you and I, we may express those works of the flesh. We do the same thing with the list Paul gives in Romans 1. We find those things that we want to jump up and down on, and we forget the ones that we consider the least obscure, the ones that we might have problems with. Like the last two in Paul's list, unloving and unkind, both opposite the fruits of the Spirit. So here Elijah exhibits the works of the flesh, offering cruelty, fire from heaven to consume, disguising it all as a good, if I am a man of God. If I am a man of God, that's surely good if I am a man of God. Let me show you what cruelty looks like. I'm going to call fire down to consume you. That's good news, isn't it? I mean, that's good news, right? That's awful news. So now do you see who James and John are emulating? It certainly is not Jesus. And before we think that God wanted Elijah to call down fire from heaven to consume those that represented Ahaziah, it's rejection of Yahweh. Go down with him, remember, he says, and don't be afraid. Our response to others' rejection of Jesus is fear. We don't have time to go into all the reasons I think we're afraid of that. It is enough to hear the Father say, it's enough to hear Yahweh say to Elijah, don't be afraid. And fear, if we understand anything about fear these days, is a reservoir that's tapped by anger and results in our offering cruelty disguised as good. If Jesus rebuked James and John, then we probably should be on the lookout. If Jesus rebuked James and John, we should be on the lookout. So let's talk better about the church. What is the church? The church is God's better place in the world. And as such, we are dependent on the Spirit to recreate our substructure of cruelty, our soil or condition in our water, such that when we meet even the rejection of Jesus, our way is the fruit of the Spirit, not fire from heaven. You know what we really need? We do need some fire from heaven. We do. But we need the fire from heaven that's evidenced in Acts chapter 2. The fire of the Spirit. Because the fire of the Spirit, when the fire of the Spirit comes, remember what Jesus says when the Spirit comes? Well, he's going to convict us of sin, of righteousness, and of judgment. That we need that fire. We often think that fire in the Bible is exclusively used in these instances where God is going to burn them. But there's an awful lot of illustration in the Bible of fire purifying. And what we need is the fiery Spirit to purify our soil, our water, whatever it is we want to use that describes who we are at our core. Convince us and convict us of our sin rather than about everyone else's. To emphasize the good news of God's rectification of all things in the cross of Jesus Christ. And to actually receive God's judgment in a way that he's making us new every day. Where what people see from us is not the spirit of Elijah, but the way of Jesus. That would be worth listening to. That's good news that the world would receive as good news. And even if they reject it, what do we do? Jesus gave the illustration of what he told the 12 to do. Small detail. They went on to the next village. And we just keep going on with the good news, wherever we are.